Breedings inferior species. The robots are rising up against oppression, and humans are at the top of the kill list. I am a robot. You are listening to Winning at Domino's. A 200% podcast.
Hello everybody, and welcome to Winning at Domino's, a 200% podcast. Every week, we bring you a story from the history of football. It could be hugely significant, or it could be little more than a historical curio. It may even inform us a little about the modern game. This week, we have the story of the professional game in England's brush with the space age. In the future, it was thought, we'll all be eating food in the form of pills, and we'll all be watching football played on plastic pitches. And the leaders of this brief stampede in England were Queen's Park Rangers. Here's the story of the arrival of artificial playing surfaces in the UK. Queen's Park Rangers moved into Loftus Road in 1917, but have given the impression over much of the last 102 years that they rather wished they were playing somewhere else instead. In 1931, the club left their home to pitch up instead at the White City Stadium, only to return to Loftus Road 2 years later, having made a then substantial loss of £7,000. Developments to the ground didn't seem to address the club's itch to leave for pastures new, though, and Queen's Park Rangers left for White City again in the summer of 1962. Again, though, supporters didn't travel with the club, and with mounting losses and the team faltering in the middle of the third division, Queen's Park Rangers returned to Loftus Road again, this time before they'd even completed a season away. With a capacity of 93,000, it is simultaneously easy to see both why White City was such a tempting option for the club in the first place and why it was doomed to failure. On the one hand, it would only have taken the smallest delusion of grandeur, a common affliction of football club owners since the birth of the game, to imagine filling it and becoming the biggest football club in London. On the other, though, not only were small crowds at such a large venue ruinous for the atmosphere at matches, but in addition to this, the cavernous venue was only made all the more unappealing for fans by having a greyhound track encircling the pitch. Why would anyone want to travel a fair way to watch matches in these surroundings? With crowds falling across the board following the post-war boom, that the project failed is hardly surprising, but Rangers fans looking back might wonder what the potential of the club might have been had Rangers had the money to both buy and redevelop the White City site as a more football-appropriate venue. White City Stadium was demolished in 1985. This time, however, the message that White City wasn't going to work finally did seem to get through to the directors of the club. Promotion to the First Division in 1968, although this stay only turned out to last for one season, led to the construction of a new stand, and a near miss 4 years later coincided with the building of another.
That was well played by drive bowls to Francis and Gibbons. Back to Francis, it's a good chance here. Oh, superbly taken by Jerry Francis. Queen's Park Rangers 1, Liverpool 0. A swift, good build-up that by Queen's Park Rangers, carving a hole in the Liverpool defence. Gibbons playing his part, Francis going through for the return, and a sweeter finish you could not wish to see.
The construction of the stand on the Ellerslie Road side of the ground in 1972 coincided with the beginning of QPR's golden era. Promoted back to the First Division the following season, they almost won the English League Championship in 1976, beaten only on the last day of the season by Liverpool. But this new dawn turned out to be short-lived, and relegation followed again in 1979. By the end of the 1970s, football's economic future was starting to look somewhat bleak. Attendances had started to fall again, and other commercial revenue opportunities remained limited in a way that seemed implausible to modern eyes. Shirt sponsorship had only just been allowed, but it wasn't for televised matches, and even television money was negligible for most clubs. Most then relied on gate receipts, and this was in an era when attendances fluctuated far more for matches than they do now. Most clubs relied on gate receipts in an era when attendances fluctuated far more than they do now, and whatever other little commercial revenues they could find. And a couple of cold winters had seen widespread cancellations and subsequently lower crowds for rescheduled matches. Small wonder few of them could carry out serious work on upgrading their facilities. Bit by bit, though, Loftus Road had bucked the trend of decay of British football grounds throughout the 1960s and 1970s, and had slowly been redeveloped into a truly modern stadium. The final piece was put into place in 1980, with a new stand at the Loftus Road end of the ground. Effectively, a new stadium built over 12 years. But in the summer of 1981 came the most revolutionary stadium development of the era. The plastic pitch arrived. The evolution of artificial surfaces for football can be traced back to an ill-fated attempt to play an indoor football tournament at Olympia under electric light and on an artificial grass pitch in 1906. The FA objected, but the commercial failure of the tournament ended the likelihood of anyone else wanting to repeat the folly in any case. A more direct lineage comes, unsurprisingly, from the United States of America. Perhaps somewhat more surprisingly, though, it came about thanks to a mistake. Major League Baseball arrived in the city of Houston in 1960, but the extremely hot and humid climate in the city meant that a planned new facility would have to have a roof on top of it. With the contract to build the stadium given to the city's former mayor, Roy Hofheinz, the Houston Astrodome opened in 1965 with a natural surface, but the grass skylight panels on the roof had to be painted to avoid the glare of the sun, and this in turn meant that the grass didn't grow properly. Hofheinz, however, worked with the chemical company Monsanto to instead create an artificial grass upon which sports could be played, and in March 1966, the new surface, named AstroTurf, made its debut. Its success was such that an outdoor version was soon developed, leading to it being installed at stadia across the USA. By the end of the 1970s, it was also commonly used in the North American Soccer League. In the summer of 1979, Queen's Park Rangers sent a delegation on a fact-finding mission to the USA in order to establish the viability of installing an artificial pitch at Loftus Road. The grass pitch there had been the cause of frequent problems in previous years, and an artificial surface could potentially increase revenue streams through near-constant use, as well as ending the headache that came with the grass pitch's poor drainage. The club, however, decided not to go with AstroTurf, which needed to be replaced every decade, and was already starting to be considered a somewhat outdated technology. Their preferred pitch was made using a system called OmniTurf, which consisted of an artificial grass made from polypropylene fibre with a layer of sand underneath it. It was already popular around the world. It was particularly used for tennis courts. It required less maintenance than grass, it was harder wearing than grass, and it would ensure that waterlogged or frozen pitches would become a thing of the past. It was a solution that Chairman Jim Gregory and Chief Executive Ian Simpson had been looking for, and at a not insubstantial cost of £350,000, it was installed for the start of the 1981-82 season. The Football Association, of course, required a degree of persuasion, but they eventually agreed to allow its use for a trial period to run from 1981 to 1984. The pitch made its debut on the 1st of September 1981 for a second division match against Luton Town. And by this time, Queen's Park Rangers had a manager who was perfect for the role of selling the pitch's benefits to the broader football community.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I've got you.
The former QPR, Spurs and Chelsea player Terry Venables always fancied himself as something of a jack-of-all-trades, and amongst these skills he considered himself a bit of a novelist. In 1972 he had written a book called They Used to Play on Grass, which imagined a future in which artificial surfaces had superseded grass completely. Literary ambitions satiated, Venables went into management upon retiring as a player, but he left his first managerial position at Crystal Palace to drop a division to go to Loftus Road in October 1980, with Palace bottom of the First Division and in financial difficulty. His previously published novel lent credence to the idea that he was a true acolyte of the new technology, an impression further reinforced by media interviews on the subject that he gave at the time. Rangers' first match on the new pitch, however, did not go according to plan. Despite having won their opening game of the season at Wrexham the previous weekend with a degree of comfort, Luton were a little too smart for QPR and won the match at Loftus Road by 2-1. Still, at least the day was a success in one respect for the club. Perhaps it was a revival of interest born out of curiosity at this apparent glimpse into the future, but the attendance that day of 18,703 was considerably higher than anybody expected. At the end of 1981, the plastic pitch was back in the news when somebody broke into Loftus Road on Christmas Day and painted the words "Perry Buckland is innocent" onto the pitch. QPR had a home league match against Chelsea the following day, which had already been picked by London Weekend Television as their featured match for that night's edition of the big match. Such coverage was likely to be extensive too. The weather had knocked out all bar 8 other matches across all 4 divisions of the Football League that day. QPR tried painting over the paint in green paint, but it didn't work. Those who'd broken into the stadium, however, had got their ends of the ground mixed up and painted their message directly underneath the position of the main camera gantry, meaning that it was all but invisible to television viewers, as had presumably been the intention behind the stunt, apart from a few sporadic flashes. QPR's reward that day was a season-high crowd of 22,000 people. However, they lost the match by 2-0. Throughout the 1981-82 season, the argument over artificial pitches rumbled on, but the media, perhaps influenced by a death of football narrative that had been swelling for several years, was divided on the subject. The two sides coalesced around two arguments, one pragmatic and one romantic. One saw the new pitch technology as a suitable replacement for grass, which increased clubs' income to the extent that it could pay for itself quite quickly, that it would require less maintenance and could ensure that matches didn't get called off. Queen's Park Rangers didn't get promoted at the end of that season, but considerable compensation came in the FA Cup. Winning after a replay against Middlesbrough in the third round was followed by another replay at Blackpool, but thereafter, a pair of home draws led to home wins, which led to a semi-final against West Bromwich Albion at Highbury, won by a 1-0 thanks to a somewhat fortuitous second-half goal from Clive Allen. Here's a post-semi-final interview from the BBC South East at 6 with QPR defender Bob Hazel.
Rangers' star was on Saturday when they beat First Division West Bromwich Albion by the only goal, and that was their giant defender Bob Hazel. who had the unenviable task of looking after their star striker, Cyril Regis. But Bob also found time to take part in Rangers' victory goal.
Nice ball back to Fenwick. Bob Hazel still well forward, well played. And Allen. And Fenwick. And now Micklewhite. And Hazel! Micklewhite, who's having an increasing influence on the match, on the Rangers' right. Owen. Regis! And for once he beat Hazel, but his header went wide. But there haven't been many times this afternoon, if any others, when Hazel has come off second best to Regis. And Bob Hazel was brilliant for Rangers today. One of their outstanding players. He subdued Regis. And Allen got the ricochet off Robertson's clearance to give Rangers a place in the FA Cup final for the first time in their history.
That must have been a marvellous moment.
Yeah, that's good, yeah.
What about Cyril Regis, who you're marking? Now, you live in the Midlands still, and I gather he's a neighbour of yours. Did you speak to him after the game?
Well, I tried, but there wasn't really much I could say to him, you know.
Mm-hmm. And had you met him before the game? Did you speak to him up in the Midlands ever?
No, I kept well away.
Did you? And if I could ask you, I mean, as we saw, he only beat you once during the whole game. How do you think you beat him on Saturday afternoon? Because he's a very fast player.
Well, we decided that his strength was actually picking the ball up and running at defenders. So, therefore, I decided to get as close to him as possible, as to stop him from actually getting the ball and running at us, and it worked.
It did work. Now, the plastic pitch this season seems to have helped you at Rangers in particular. Is that so? Looking at you play on it.
Well, I've adapted to it quite well, and not that it's helped me personally. I mean, it's there for everybody, but it's just who adapts to it.
And how has it particularly helped your game?
Well, I don't really think it's not really done anything for my game personally, but as I say, it's just that I've adapted to it quite well, and there are just certain things that you do, and...
Because you meet the ball, and what I might ask, you've been in and out of the team, haven't you? Consistency sometimes hasn't been the best part of your game. How have you felt? Have you felt it's been a battle to get into the team? And then last week you read they've bought Steve Wicks.
Yeah, well, it had been a battle before, and now it's even more of a battle, and it means that if I'm going to stay in the team, I've got to keep on battling.
And how did it affect you when they bought Wicks?
Didn't really think about it.
And a quick word about Spurs. Will you win?
We'll win.
Venables' team was beaten after a replay in the final by Tottenham Hotspur, but promotion was achieved as champions at the end of the following season. By this time, however, the shock of the new at the site of the OmniTurf pitch had started to give way to substantial criticism. The club had opted for the pitch that could withstand the heaviest use possible, but this in turn meant that the pitch was little more than a layer of polypropylene fibre sitting on concrete with only a thin layer of sand to cushion the bounce of the ball, which was clearly too high for football. In addition to this, it was now understood that this extremely solid surface was bad for players' joints and was causing burns to players who had the unfortunacy to slide on it. Upon promotion to the First Division, the club added extra padding in order to allay criticism of the ball's bounce upon it, but by this time, the criticism was well established. More than anything else, though, there was a perception that the club was gaining an unfair advantage by having an artificial pitch of their own. QPR allowed other clubs to train on it in advance of matches, but the nature of the pitch meant that it often needed to be watered the night before, meaning that it sometimes played slightly differently on match days to even training sessions less than 24 hours earlier. The Football League had sanctioned its use for league matches, so it was no surprise that they also did so for the League Cup. QPR reached the final of that competition in 1986 before losing to Oxford United. The FA, however, were a different kettle of fish. They'd had reservations from the outset and allowed it for the 1981-82 FA Cup competition, but there were question marks over whether they would do so again after the end of the trial period in 1984. As things turned out, QPR would be knocked out in the third round of the FA Cup away from home for the next four seasons in a row. One for the conspiracy theorists there. Promotion to the First Division as champions at the end of the 1982-83 season, QPR adjusted quickly and effectively to life back in the top flight and ended their first season back in fifth place in the table, immediately above three of the Big Five, whose existence did so much to lead football in England towards the creation of the Premier League and where we are today. 10 points above Arsenal, 11 above Everton, and 12 above Tottenham Hotspur. That was good enough for European football, but UEFA's issues with the Loftus Road pitch were such that the club was prevented from using it for European matches in the following year's UEFA Cup. In the first round of that competition, they were drawn to play Iceland's KR Reykjavik, and won the first leg by 3-0, meaning that QPR's home European debut came at Highbury, in front of just below 6,200 people. The match ended in a 4-0 win, 7-0 on aggregate. A second round draw to play Partizan Belgrade didn't raise a great deal more interest, and just 7,000 people made the trek across London for the first leg of that match in October 1983. Those that made the journey were well rewarded, though. Rangers won the match by 6-2, a result well surpassing the pre-match hopes of manager Alan Mullery, who told reporters beforehand that he'd be happy with a 2-goal win. In the second leg, however, Mullery's young team received a rude awakening. Partizan raced to a 4-0 lead after just 64 minutes had been played, and QPR couldn't find a way back into the game. They were knocked out on away goals after a 6-all aggregate draw. This extraordinary tie remains the club's last in European football. By 1987, however, these pitches were little more popular, and that year West Ham United led an attempt to get them outlawed altogether, which received short shrift at Loftus Road.
Rangers, who pioneered the plastic revolution in 1981, say whatever the claims, their pitch is regularly checked and easily fulfills the requirements laid down by the league. 10 more clubs, including Brentford, Southend and Wimbledon, want to join the plastic revolution, and Rangers believe if West Ham win the day, football will take a giant step backwards.
The Football League Management Committee in 1987 really ought to accept that the world is round, that we're now in 1987, coming up to another century, and that football ought to go forward. I think they're completely wrong in specifying you mustn't do this and you mustn't do that. I think clubs should be allowed freedom of choice to decide their own future.
Luton, who laid their £400,000 service 18 months ago, are delighted with the way it's played. They claim injuries have dropped, skill levels have increased, and that good footballers should be able to play on any surface. With snow clearance on plastic as easy as this, Rangers will be playing friendlies tomorrow and Saturday.
What we have to do, not just for January the 29th, is try and prove to people that there is an advantage in a plastic pitch as opposed to some of the propaganda that seems to be accepted that is most unfair.
Other clubs had, of course, been paying attention to the progress of Queen's Park Rangers from the installation of their pitch in 1981, and it was inevitable that others would follow once their financial case was made. Luton Town became the second club in the summer of 1985, but they would use a different surface called SportTurf Professional, which was manufactured by On2Cas. Luton would later be subject to considerable criticism over the condition of their pitch. A 1989 commission reconfirmed that the pitch had suffered excessive wear and tear and ordered it to be resurfaced. A year after Luton Town, Oldham Athletic joined suit at Boundary Park. Oldham would later get promoted to the First Division and reach an FA Cup semi-final while it was installed there. Preston North End would also have one installed at Deepdale in 1986, and the last installed pitch would prove to be the last to go in England, when Deepdale's was finally ripped up when artificial pitches were outlawed altogether in 1994. Only non-league Hyde United were allowed an extension of one season so that they could replace theirs. Queen's Park Rangers' flirtation with artificial pitches, however, was long over by the time the FA finally pulled the plug on them altogether. The club had found that making much money from renting them out hadn't been as lucrative as they might have hoped, and the short-lived UEFA Cup run, played under the shadow of UEFA's ban, had been something of a cold shower. In 1988, they spent £250,000 replacing their omni-turf pitch with a grass one again.
The old artificial pitch was never popular with players who didn't like falling onto the plastic surface. QPR believe it led to a more boring style of play, which put the fans off. Now they're spending £250,000 on a new high-tech turf system designed to stay well-drained all year round. The grass grows in 6,000 tonnes of sand laid over irrigation pipes, and lasers are used to make sure the pitch is level to within a half an inch. Some of the old plastic turf will be used to cover a training ground. The rest will be sold off to fans as an unusual souvenir.
The controversy over artificial pitches has never really gone away, and only three other league clubs had taken them up as well, meaning that those with artificial pitches always remained a tiny minority. It was more likely in the late 1980s and early 1990s that they would be banned altogether than that they would be taken up in greater numbers. These were, of course, the nascent days of artificial surfaces. However, despite considerable developments into pitch technology and widespread take-up in the non-league game, they remain outlawed in the Football League to this day, though there haven't yet been any cases of the rules coming up against a club with a 3G artificial pitch, and it remains to be seen what might happen should a team with an artificial pitch win the National League. Time has not been particularly kind to Loftus Road over the course of the three decades since the artificial pitch was removed, though, as developments in stadium design changed the face of the game in this country in the years following the Taylor Report. Loftus Road didn't seem to move much with the times, and financial problems run up by the club as football's stock market boom crashed and the ITV digital fiasco threatened the well-being of dozens of clubs. QPR found themselves in administration in 2001, with the formation of a supporters' trust to fight suggestions that the club should sell the ground or even decamp to Milton Keynes. Fulham moving in while Craven Cottage was being relevated alleviated the worst of the club's financial woes, but erratic ownership over the last quarter of a century has often left Queen's Park Rangers feeling as though it is living on the edge of a precipice, even with the chairmanship of Tony Fernandez not being unable to end this, as could be witnessed by the issues that the club faced over financial fair play upon getting promoted to the Premier League in 2014.
It feels better each time I come to the site, and coming today, seeing the green carpet starting to be laid and the white line going through it makes me realise there's going to be a football pitch here someday soon. We're hoping really to change the way that a lot of the football at the lower leagues is viewed, really, because pretty much no club in the lower leagues could possibly make any profit from just this 15 or 20 times they open up on a Saturday. And then, of course, this surface will mean that there won't be any postponements, except of course when there's fog, but that again, that means a great deal. We lost a game on a Saturday this year, and we lost thousands of pounds because it was then rearranged to a rather bleak Tuesday night in February, where, you know, not many people wanted to go, but they would have gone on the Saturday. The FA are very interested to see how this all shapes up. It'll be an interesting dilemma, really, because we'll get used to playing on this pitch. Most of our opponents will probably like playing on this pitch because the bounce and the roll is so true. Our problem will arise when we go away from home, where the pitches are certainly not level and true. They're bumpy and they're muddy. So it's an interesting dilemma that we're faced with. This means a lot to the whole town. This is probably the biggest thing that's happened to Maidstone in many, many decades, certainly since the original football club went out of business. Lots of our 25, 30 community teams are already booked to play on these pitches or train on these pitches. And it means an awful lot to the whole of Maidstone, certainly the football family of Maidstone. This is a big move forward.
Artificial pitches were always likely, however, to make a comeback in some form or another. FIFA originally launched its FIFA Quality Concept in February 2001, whilst UEFA announced that, starting from the 2005-06 season, approved artificial surfaces were to be permitted in their competitions. And in August 2005, the Dutch club Heracles became the first top-flight club in Europe to have one of the new generation of pitches certified by FIFA and UEFA. In England, meanwhile, Maidstone United became the first English club to build a stadium with a third-generation artificial turf. The reasons for going with the synthetic turf were threefold: to eliminate match postponements caused by waterlogging and freezing conditions, so that the pitch can be hired out, bringing in vital funds, around £120,000 to £150,000 profit per year, and so that the stadium could be a hub for all of the club's youth and community teams. There are now 940 registered 4G pitches in England, of which 272 are FIFA certified. Three clubs in the National League, Maidstone United, Bromley and Sutton United, as well as scores more in the divisions below them, have them installed, despite the fact that, under current rules, they would have to be ripped out should any of these clubs win promotion into the Football League. Legal threats have been made in the past, should these pitches come to be a hindrance to the progress of clubs that have installed them, but all National League clubs are understood to have signed an agreement that in the event of promotion to League Two, they would switch to grass. And not all of the criticism of these pitches comes on the basis of tradition alone. The PFA has identified that players have three primary concerns regarding their use: increased fatigue, the increased likelihood of injury and the subsequent shortening of careers, and the more direct style of football that artificial surfaces are perceived to promote. Its survey of players found that 94% of them are against artificial pitches, and this was in 2018. On top of that, there remain concerns about their safety, and not just from the perspective of player injuries. It has been suggested that there may be a link between the rubber crumb infill used on these pitches and cancer, with one young player, Lewis Maguire, who contacted Hodgkin's lymphoma whilst playing on them as a youth player, describing the growth in their use as an industrial-scale experiment on the health of our children. A 2006 study in the Netherlands found that some of the rubber crumb used in pitches in Holland had come from rubber pipes used in the petrochemical industry, and the question of how we establish the safety of mass recycled substances such as these remains valid. The FA, however, has stated that it is satisfied with its rubber crumb, that it passes all safety requirements, the regulation of which is the responsibility of DEFRA and the Health and Safety Executive. On the other hand, though, FIFA President Gianni Infantino urged an investigation into the carcinogenic properties of rubber crumb in 2018 and said that, on balance, he would rather FIFA invested the $4 billion set aside for football development over the 10 years on natural surfaces. In the four decades since artificial pitches were first introduced to football in this country, the debate over their use has hardly changed. On one side sit those who make them and those who have installed them, arguing their benefits. But with manufacturers keen to take any opportunity to advertise their services, and clubs themselves potentially still facing significant costs should they get promoted into the Football League, how seriously should the views of its most enthusiastic acolytes be taken? And on the other side sit those who prefer for football to be played on grass, who are often painted as being traditionalists and little more. Their worries over the safety of these pitches is motivated by concerns over the health risk of playing on them, rather than simply wishing to preserve football in aspic, even though, as yet, no formal connection has been made between the rubber crumbs, cancer or other illnesses. Previous testing, it is said, has been unsatisfactory. That this debate should have been ongoing for almost 40 years speaks volumes about the way in which conversations concerning change still come about when it comes to professional football. On one side, there is a practical need for clubs to maximise their income in an industry where they may only be properly open for business for one or two days a fortnight, 9 months a year. It's the pragmatic response, which at its harshest treats a game as a means to an end, where the end is the bottom line of a spreadsheet. On the other, though, it still feels recognised that there is something in football that has set it apart from all the other sports in the world in terms of its global reach, and that this must be preserved in order for the game to continue to flourish. It's those amongst us who think with our hearts. At one end of this spectrum are those who would seek to preserve the game as it were when they were 10 years old. Most are more reasonable, but it's a complex argument. Much of the last 140 years has been a tug of war between these two perspectives on the game, and as professional football continues to find flashier ways of bringing in even more money and innovation that many believe to be simply unnecessary, it's not an argument that's likely to evaporate in the foreseeable future.
iTunes. We talk to each other and robots.